Communication will be called to order. First up on the agenda, we have an informational presentation from the Office of Higher Education on the Direct Admissions Minnesota program. Our testifiers will be Dr. Wendy Robinson as well as Aaron Salasek. So please welcome to the front. Please introduce yourselves for the record and proceed.
Hello, thank you, Senator Chair Frate and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wendy Robinson, and I'm somebody who needs to pull the microphone closer. There we go. And I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Programs, Policies, and Grants at the Office of Higher Education. And we are delighted to join you today to talk broadly about some of our opportunities to promote college access and attainment for students, and then more specifically to do a bit of a deep dive into our Direct Admissions program, which is a program that we're really proud of and are able to share some new data about our findings from our second year of the program this afternoon. So as you all know, in 2015, Minnesota set an ambitious statewide attainment goal to increase the percentage of Minnesotans who have a post-secondary credential. A key cornerstone to that work starts with increasing student access and awareness of higher education opportunities and their access to post-secondary opportunities. And so we know that we need to make sure that students know that higher education means more than just a traditional four-year college, that they know that there are opportunities for community colleges, for technical colleges, for our tribal colleges, for public institutions, for private institutions. We know that affordability is a concern, and so that we have to be constantly working to make sure students are aware of how to access financial aid opportunities, the opportunities available to them at both the federal level and the state level, and then also to make sure that we're continuing to work in collaboration and partnership with other folks in the state who are doing this work as well. I think one of the guiding questions for OHE when it comes to talking about access programming and outreach and financial aid awareness is, what's OHE's lane? What are we as a state government agency best positioned to do in an era where we always know that there are finite resources of time and staff and dollars? What are areas where we can still... Okay. Let me skip this over here. Where are the opportunities where we can partner with folks who are already doing really good work in this space, whether that's at the K-12 level, whether that's a community organization, a college access group, a college or university partners, and what are programs like Direct Admissions that really have to be operated at the statewide level because we are able to work across agencies, across sectors as much as possible? So our presentation today, we're not going to dive into every program that OHE does that's related to student access because we would be here all afternoon. And we're not going to really highlight some of the ones where OHE really provides more of a supportive role for things like our ICAP program and some of those other opportunities. And so we'll just do a little bit of information about some of the outreach that we do and then more of our time spent on efforts around FAFSA and then efforts around Direct Admissions. So promoting access to higher education starts by identifying what are some of the challenges, concerns, fears, barriers that students and their families might have as they approach this process. And so looking to see, how do we provide direct information to students and parents, recognizing that as a state agency, we have the ability to give non-biased information, to give information not just how do you get admitted to one particular college, but how do you approach searching for college generally? How do you pay for college generally? And so we do a number of opportunities where we get into direct contact with students and parents. Some of those opportunities are through a wide variety of both print and electronic materials that we make available. We have some great brochures. We have videos in a variety of formats and languages around how to fill out a FAFSA, how to access higher education. We also do direct outreach through participating in student success conferences, doing presentations through community organizations and high schools, doing virtual information sessions that students in all corners of the state can access this information as well. Some of those examples of where we have provided information about how to access college just this year have included doing our Get Ready conference, doing information with Move Forward, which is a program for unhoused youth, attending things like a Native American college fair, also being really out in the public at our state fair booth, attending events like the Hmong New Year celebration, kind of lots of different places where we can go and provide that information around college access. I can tell you, as somebody who has done her fair share of shifts at the state fair, the number one questions that we tend to get asked there are about college costs and about financial aid. And so when we bring our resources, all of our print materials and our resources there, that's the number one brochure that people are grabbing. And that's the space where we do hear the most questions and the kind of the largest perceived barrier, I think, around accessing higher education. We also really enjoy our opportunities to collaborate with K-12 staff, with folks doing college access work through nonprofit organizations, and with folks on college campuses. And so we provide opportunities for professional development, for information sharing, providing logistical and presentation support for schools that are doing, you know, their own FAFSA information night or their own going to college night. Always working with our partners to determine, you know, what are the gaps? What are the things that you need materials about? What are the questions that you're seeing from your students and your families? You know, where can we provide resources in that space as well? A few other specific initiatives that I'll highlight real quickly. We recently received a grant from the Lumina Foundation called the Connect College Grant. This was partially in response to actually, Lumina kind of reaching out directly to us and saying, we really love what you're doing with direct admissions, and we'd like to think about what more you can do around that and what are some additional add-ons that you can do that will help more high schools be able to participate in direct admissions and to continue to advance that work. And so through the funding of that grant opportunity, we are able to fund some high school students to actually do college visits to schools within Minnesota. Aaron and I, my colleague Aaron Salzik, who will introduce himself in a minute, have been going around the state to do regional counselor convenings where we're pulling together groups of high school counselors, providing professional development opportunities for them, helping them get, if they're not already a direct admission school, helping them get equipped to become a direct admission school or answer any questions that they have about that process, talking a lot about financial aid, providing financial aid training and information for those folks. Those have been really, really successful, and we'll be continuing to do those until the duration of the Lumina grant. We also, as you're probably familiar, we do have our Get Ready program, which is funded through the Federal Department of Education through their Gear Up dollars. And this is a program that's designed to serve low-income first-generation high school students to ensure that they have the academic preparation that they need to be successful to make that transition into post-secondary education and to increase high school graduation rates and then ultimately increase rates of college attainment. We were recently refunded for the next grant cycle, so we're very, very excited about that opportunity. And we will serve approximately 7,500 low-income students across 14 capacity-building schools and then 28 additional schools where we're not based at that school but providing them some resources and support as well. Through our Get Ready program, we provide things like academic tutoring, career exploration, college visits, success coaching, support for completing applications, support for completing financial aid, and giving additional financial aid resources as well. Some of our Get Ready schools are also direct admission schools, so that's really exciting that they're really getting a variety of interventions from the state to really see their students' academic success and their college attainment rates increase. We are accountable to both the state and the federal government for this program, and so every year we're tracking a variety of metrics to see are the interventions that Get Ready are doing, do they work? What students, you know, where are we seeing success? As of our last grant cycle, we saw that 4 out of our 7 partner schools did see increases in their FAFSA completion rates, and then 5 out of our 7 partner schools did see substantially increased college enrollment rates prior to compared to their previous rates.
Thank you. I had a quick question.
Yes.
For the Get Ready portion, it said you served approximately 7,500 students across 14 capacity building schools. Do you have any demographic data around those 7,500 students?
So thank you for the question, Senator Fede. We do, but I don't have it with me, but I'd be glad to pull it for you. Or I suspect Nikki might be in the audience, maybe pulling it up for us as we speak. As we have mentioned several times in committee, last year was an enormously challenging year for students wanting to complete the FAFSA. And so we've always had opportunities to try to promote financial aid awareness and financial aid access. And particularly that felt particularly important last year, given all of the challenges that existed at the federal level. So some of our FAFSA outreach opportunities that I do want to highlight just quickly include our Ready, Set, FAFSA program. which is a virtual financial aid information session for students and families, where we saw 1,300 unique registrations for our October sessions and 939 unique registrations for our January series. So we're really, the virtual opportunity is great because it really gives us an opportunity to get out past the Twin Cities metro area and to provide that information to students in greater Minnesota as well. We provide ongoing financial aid outreach and training to K-12 and college staff on both implementation for state financial aid programs, especially with new ones like North Star Promise, and then additional, you know, being that conduit of information for changes that might be coming from the federal level and information around FAFSA Simplification Act and additional FAFSA processing. And then we both directly and then in partnership with other organizations several opportunities for FAFSA completion events last year, including information by having financial aid professionals at the state fair, having some one-on-one opportunities for students. And then we're going to continue to do FAFSA outreach as well, including our next financial aid event will be in Duluth in next month. So we're looking forward to getting up there. I'm going to transition now to talking about our direct admissions program, unless there's any other questions about related to our outreach opportunities. Thank you. All right, well, I am always really excited to talk about direct admissions, and that's good because we get asked about direct admissions all the time. Erin and I have, in the last 2 years, probably been contacted by, I think we're now up to maybe 20 other states that have reached out to us to say, how are you doing it? What does this program look like? What are your outcomes? As well as being reached out to by both local and national media to talk about the program. And I think there's a reason that this program gets as much attention as it does. And that's because it's working, and it's also really bringing in, I think, a necessary measure of sanity to the college admissions process, which is something that students and families tend to have a lot of anxiety around and have a lot of fear around that will I get in question. Direct admissions is designed to bypass that, to say, like, if you are able to graduate from high school in Minnesota, you have college opportunities. You are college material. And I think that's a really important message for students to hear and to understand. It's also a space where we get to do direct intervention to talk to them through both our written communications, through some of our direct admissions events and our materials about the importance of things like completing their FAFSA, about doing college exploration activities. So direct admissions, this is the fourth year of the program with our third cohort. So we had 1 year of program design. I think it's fair to say we're the most comprehensive direct admissions model in the country. The expansion of direct admissions is happening really rapidly across the country, but as far as we know, at this time, we are the only model that includes both private and public institutions, both two-year and four-year colleges. And that was really intentionally designed from the beginning. We wanted to go in with the most expansive view of what college meant for our students and recognize that that's one of the advantages of Minnesota is that we have wonderful opportunities at a variety of types of institutions. This program has always been designed to scale, and we've grown every year and will continue to grow until we are fully scaled. And we are every year also working really closely with our partners to do process improvements, to do program improvements, to try to make it as easy a lift as possible for our high school partners and as valuable an opportunity for our college and university partners as possible. So from the beginning, we've had working groups with our K-12 partners and our higher ed partners and have really collaborated a lot to make it a program that works for everybody, that is has a lot of buy-in and has had a lot of buy-in from day one because it's been such a collaborative and transparent process. One of the other sort of essential elements of direct admissions has always been that this would not be something that would ever limit a student's choice, and that we say we want to give you the most comprehensive opportunities that you can, and then you get to make choices about what school is going to be the right fit for you. So students will receive a letter that gives them a list of institutions that are willing to say yes to them based on their academic performance through their junior year of high school. There are different tiers, and the colleges and universities got to opt into the tier that felt appropriate to them for their admission standards and their admissions goals. So students will get a list that has as many as 55 colleges and universities or as few as, I think, 29. And so then they'll get to determine, once a student gets that letter and the additional information, they get to determine if they want to engage in that, and then they can read it and decide that not to engage in the direct admissions program. They can use that and then use that as an opportunity to initiate communication and the application process with those schools, with the advantage of if they go through the direct admissions program, they don't have to pay any college application fees. So we get to save our students a little bit of money on the front end. As I mentioned before, we have 55 colleges and universities participating, which we're really excited about those partnerships. And we have grown from our first pilot year. We had 46 high schools. Year two, we had 120. Year three, we're at 182. We are anticipating continuing to grow, which I'll let Aaron talk about later on. This year, our direct admissions cohort of students is just over 32,000 students. And as you can see from the map, we are really trying to cover all of Minnesota, and have been really intentional about trying to make sure that we're reaching out and having as broad of participation as we can. As I mentioned, our next direct admissions report will be coming out in the next couple of weeks, but you guys are getting a sneak preview at some of our data about our outcomes. If you'll remember from last year, we had some really exciting findings from our pilot year that showed that students participating in direct admissions were completing FAFSA at significantly higher rates. They were enrolling in college. They were staying in Minnesota. And so we were really curious to see if we would see the same kind of findings in year two, given that the scale of the program had increased so much. And I'll give you a little bit of a spoiler alert. The news is good, so we're going to continue to talk about the data, but we've seen some really positive trends continue from that first year into the second year. One of the things that we do note is that there will be a few times where I talk about direct admissions high schools, and then so a few times we talk about direct admissions participants. So when we talk about high schools, we are talking about all of the students who are in that 12th grade who all got a direct admissions letter, whether they accessed the direct admissions resources and participated in the program or not. And when we talk about participants, we're talking about students who got their direct admissions letter, looked it over, made some thoughtful choices, selected the schools that they wanted to engage in. So I'll just try to make sure I'm clear which population we're talking about at a given time. We do believe that students who go to direct admissions high schools still benefit from the program even if they don't engage in their direct admissions process. Partially, they're benefiting because they are getting that additional outreach about financial aid opportunities. Partially, they're benefiting because they are, some of those students may read their letter and that might motivate them to apply, and then they just, when they apply, they just don't go through direct admissions and they just apply directly, so they're still kind of getting influenced by that process. And they're still ultimately getting that message that you have great options, you are desired by these colleges and universities, you are somebody who is college material. One of the findings that we did see is that for students who, when we look on the column on the, we have one column that's the percent of all the seniors enrolled in direct admissions, and then the column that is the students who are direct admissions participants. And you can see that we have more female students engaging in the direct admissions program than male students, even though there are more male students in the cohort year. That is a finding that is consistent with the first year of the program as well, and it's consistent with what we're seeing with national trends, which is that enrollment levels continue to increase for female students but have been declining for male students. This is a table that shows the participants in the direct admissions, so all of the participants in the second cohort year of the program. And there, the blue chart is, again, all of the students at the high schools, and then the green chart are the students at those high schools that opted in to participate with direct admissions. A couple of findings that I want to highlight that will be included in the report is that compared to the first year of the program, we did see a slight decrease in the percentage of students who identify as American Indian and white participating in the program. And we saw an increase in participation for students who identify as Asian, Black, or African American, and saw more students in that population engaging in the program. The rates for Hispanic and multiracial students stayed the same from year one to year two. An important bit of context is that because the second year of the program is such a larger pool of students and a larger pool of high schools, it's not apples to apples in terms of the demographic comparison. So the second year of the program, the student population overall is a more diverse student population than the first year of the program was. Another measure that we track and we look closely at is the engagement in the program by students who benefit from and participate in the free and reduced lunch program. Interestingly, this year it is exactly equal. The percentage of students at the high schools who are free and reduced lunch and the percentage of students who participate in the program that are free and reduced lunch is exactly the same. And this is actually a nice improvement from our first year of the program. So, compared to the previous year, we had more students who indicated that they were eligible for free and reduced lunch. And because, again, we had a larger pool of students, we had a slightly more diverse pool of students this year. But we also saw a significant increase in program participation of that pool of students. So in the first year of the program, 21% of the students who indicated that they qualified for free and reduced lunch engaged in the program. And this year we had 40%. So the pool got bigger, but the participation also got quite a bit larger as well. This is our chart looking at FAFSA completion. That is one of the stated goals of the program, is to have this be an opportunity that to really promote FAFSA. I will tell you, this was one of the measures that I was most eager to see what our findings would be, given what the FAFSA challenges that this cohort of students faced. And so I was kind of like, oh, I'm going to cross my fingers and hope that, you know, we did enough supportive work around that that it could overcome some of the FAFSA barriers that were, you know, outside of the control of the students, the state, their schools. And so what you can see is this is looking at all of the students who attended direct admissions participating in high schools and some really nice measurable improvements in the FAFSA completion rate. If we drilled down to just students who engaged in direct admissions, this number would get even higher. But I think it's important to look at the overall for the entire school because I want to see that even the students who are not participating in the program are still having some positive benefits in this category. And then here is the information around FAFSA completion disaggregated by race and ethnicity data that we have. One thing that I will note that kind of pops out as an immediate concern or an area that we are wanting to pay some special attention to is, again, our American Indian and Alaska Native population, because that was a group that did have a decline in FAFSA completion this year, kind of pretty significantly and more so than any other population. We're going to continue to drill down into that data. I can share that the number of American Indian students from the first year of the program to the second year is significantly higher. So in program year one, we had 99 students in that category. In program year two, we had 579 students. And then in this year's program, we have 902 students participating. And so, apples to apples comparisons get a little bit hard when your population size changes that much. But I do think it's something that as we think about opportunities for doing college access work and doing FAFSA and financial aid information and support to make sure that we're being really thoughtful about serving that population of students and seeing if we have any gaps if there's unmet needs that we can continue to look at. This is looking at the FAFSA completion rates by looking at students who are free and reduced lunch eligible. And so you can see the FAFSA completion rates have increased both for students who are not free and reduced lunch price eligible and for students who fall into that category, which is really good because we know that the students who qualify for free and reduced lunch are very likely to be eligible for a variety of both state and federal financial aid opportunities. And so we want to make sure that they're aware of that as they begin their college exploration. As we've mentioned several times in this committee, Minnesota continues to be a net exporter of college students. So when we look at our graduating high school seniors and the amount that we send out to other states versus the amount that come in from other states, we are still in a deficit of that. And so one of the other goals for direct admissions was to really try to promote Minnesota higher education and make sure that students are really considering their in-state options because we want to keep our best and our brightest here in the state if we can. And so one of the things that we have been measuring is to see whether that number is changing. And so you can see through this chart that we have seen continued growth of our students who are in the direct admissions high schools, that a slightly higher percentage of them are staying in the state of Minnesota. And I will note that we have been looking into the data about the demographics of the students who are most likely to leave the state of Minnesota and kind of better understand that population of students and what might be driving some of that decision making, which I'll highlight on a future chart that we can kind of talk a little bit about who's leaving and maybe why they're leaving a little bit. This will show the increases in college enrollment based on sex. And so the blue line is male, the green line is female. Both populations have seen some increases, but we're again still seeing that continuation of the national trend where our female students are enrolling in college at higher percentages than our male students.
I just want to answer the question.
If I can turn it over to Nikki to answer a question for us.
Thank you, Chair Fate. And for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver, Director of Government Relations and Community Engagement for the Office of Higher Education. And I should get sticky notes so I can pass your notes next time. Just to answer the question that was asked earlier about Get Ready and the demographic breakdown, we do have the demographic breakdowns usually by race, gender, and grade level. Staff is going to pull the most recent data, and we'll send that to you later. So, yeah. You're welcome. Sorry to interrupt you.
All right, our next chart is looking at students who are participating in direct admissions high schools and whether they're enrolling in Minnesota colleges or universities. And then this is, again, disaggregated by race and ethnicity. You'll see the bottom line is our American Indian student population, which we already noted that we had some concerns about that population and are wanting to do some more research into some of the findings around that. The other thing that you'll note is in the middle, the light blue line that ends with 30%, that is our white student population. When we look at our students who are most likely to be going out of state, it is disproportionately our white students who have a family income that is puts them outside of the range where they're likely to qualify for state financial aid programs. And so when we look at all of our students who go to other states for higher education, of that total population, 83% of those are white students. And so when we kind of look at some of these charts, it's just kind of an interesting, you know, if you look at sort of college going rates, generally you're not, these numbers end up looking a little bit different than sort of overall college attainment rates for high school graduates. I think the other thing I would highlight is that, again, we're just seeing progress largely across most of the categories, again, except for that American Indian population. This figure shows the percentage of direct admissions, students at direct admissions high school, and again, looking at that free and reduced lunch category of students. And you can see a pretty big spike this year for that population of students. They're the blue line. I think that may demonstrate also some of the impact of the North Star Promise and some of the messaging around that and some of the financial aid awareness that may have happened there. I think it's probably pretty logical to assume that students who are free and reduced lunch eligible are probably going to be North Star Promise eligible as well, assuming if they're enrolling at our public institutions. So I think there may, you know, while we'd love to take all the credit for that with direct admissions, we probably should be fair and say that our financial aid outreach and the North Star Promise and highlighting, again, state grant opportunities probably helped with this as well. As I mentioned, our full report will be issued soon, but you know, we continue to just be excited that even with as challenging of a year last year with FAFSA, we're continuing to demonstrate positive outcomes in all of the categories that this program was designed to generate positive outcomes in. We have continued to have great success in building those collaborations with our K-12 partners. Every year we hear really, really beautiful stories about how impactful the program is to students. I think every year we get a little bit better at running the program and keeping it streamlined. And you know, we recognize that our high school counselors have a lot on their plate, have some pretty big caseloads. And so we think direct admissions is a great way that we can provide some support to them to give them some additional resources to help with that college exploration part of the work that they do. I'll pause now and then turn it over to Aaron, who's going to talk about where we're at with the program for this year.
Thank you for the invitation today, Chair Fate, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you here, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Salsek. I am the Direct Admissions Coordinator at Office of Higher Education, and it's good to meet you. Wendy gave a broad overview of last year's cohort, the 2023-2024 Direct Admissions class. I am going to give you sort of a status update, point in time, on where we're at in the current cohort, 2024-2025. It's always important that to keep in mind that this work is ongoing. So when we report to you, when we release that report on February 1st, it's an in-progress snapshot in time. You know, we don't close the year, so to speak, for students. We have a number of high schools and districts that include their alternative learning centers, their area learning programs, students transfer between districts, and so students can take advantage of this program throughout the entire academic calendar year. So the census date for the data that I'm sharing with you is the 17th of last month, January. So for the current program year of 2024-2025, if you go back to the map that you had in front of you at one of the earlier slides, we have 182 participating high schools with an enrolled estimate of 31,172 seniors across the state. That comprises 56 of our 80-plus counties. And as Dr. Robinson said, we have the goal of being in every county in Minnesota within the next 4 years. Almost half of enrolled seniors, about 43%, identify as Black, Indigenous, and students of color, and 36% of students are eligible for free and reduced price meals. One key metric that I have my eyes on is when do we hit that 50% saturation of the senior class across the state? We're really close. We were about 46% this year of the seniors across Minnesota, which is kind of an exciting number. 100 of our high schools are located in the 7-county Twin Cities region, and among students enrolled in grade 12 at participating high schools, 53% are from the 7-county Twin Cities region. So again, data is still incoming for this year, but as of January 31st, we have 168 high schools having sent their data to the agency, and then those students' information being redistributed to colleges. This is 69 more high schools compared to that same point roughly in time last year. And last year's cohort ended at 115 total high schools taking advantage of the program. Also sort of equally exciting, we've received 47,629 requests for proactive admission. And the unduplicated student count is 7,314. In terms of snapshot and time comparison, that's 16,126 more than last year. And last year's cohort ended at a little shy of 35,000 requests for proactive admission. The median number, which was an important metric that we wanted to assess for our college partners, enrollment projections are difficult to forecast. And so there was some concern about, if it's an open survey and students can select up to 55 institutions, if they're in that top tier, how many are they going to select? Well, when we get those questions, as an agency, we assess them. And so the median actually was 4. And almost 20% of students selected only one institution via direct admissions. I think that's an important point, largely because some of the wraparound goals of the program are education around college access and college knowledge. And so students are being judicious in their choices through this program. That's below the national median of 7 college applications per student. So I'm really excited about that because it's showing that students are being wise in their college choice and college search. So for this year, again, as of January 17th, this is the rough breakdown of our current cohort. So next year when we're here at this time, you'll see sort of the results that Wendy had just gone over with the 2023-2024 class, but for 24-25. So you can see that the distribution across demographics is actually proportionally almost the same. That's exciting because roughly speaking, we added about 30% to the overall student class for direct admissions this year compared to the prior year. So 14% or a little over 4,000 Black and African American students, 902 American Indian or Native American students, 3%. That 3% is the same as last year, but it was 1% 2 years ago. Asian students, about 10% of the cohort. Hispanic and Latino, 13. White, 56. Two or more races, 5. And unreported, 1%. So the total cohort of 31,000, you can see that there's a good distribution across demographics. And the same holds for the metric around free and reduced price lunch as well. It's almost the same proportionately as it was in the prior year. So to dive into the request for proactive admission, the 47,000 and continuing requests for admission, the distribution is also fairly similar to the prior year in terms of our higher education partners across the state. So the Minnesota State two-year institutions are seeing about 38% of overall requests. The 7 Minnesota State Universities, 20. The U of M, which again is Duluth, Crookston, Rochester, and Morris, is about 12%. Those of our private colleges and universities that are participating, 29%. Tribal College is 1%, and then we do also track the option of I'm not interested in direct admissions, and that's 253 students, so almost negligible. Before I sort of pivot to future state of the program, I just wanted to also give you a snapshot on the percent of students by academic tier. So if you remember, the program design has six academic tiers. Tier one is the most open access tier. And so for a student to get the 28 institutions that have opted into tier one, they have a GPA, an unweighted cumulative GPA of a 2.5 or less. That proportionately is about 17% of students within the direct admissions cohort. Tier two, which is a unweighted cumulative GPA of 2.5 to 2.74, is 7%, and we have eight additional institutions opting in at that level. Tier three, which was 2.75 to 2.99, you have an additional five institutions, and it's about 4% of students across the cohort. Tier four, which has the academic qualifier of the C average letter grade or higher in the core areas of English, science, and math, but the same GPA band as tier three, has 5% of the students. For tier five, which goes from GPA of three to four, has about 27%. And tier six, 3.5 or higher with the academic qualifier again, has 41%. One thing of note, which we'll talk about on the very next slide, but you'll notice that there is, at least by the institutional distribution across the tiers, there's only one institution in tier four and one institution in tier six. We've had concerted dialogue with those two institutions about the possibility of removing the academic qualifier of the C average letter grade or higher in science, English, and math. They were amenable to those discussions, and so we might be looking at a model next year that's simplified, more equitable in that it's more accessible for students and families, more easily understood, and more easily implemented through the technologies and platforms available at our secondary partner institutions. So as Dr. Robinson has already mentioned, the goal is to continue to scale. And so we hope to have an additional 100 high schools in next year's cohort, putting us close to 300. We do continue to incorporate private and parochial high schools that have interest in the program. And we'd love to broaden the alternative learning centers, alternative learning programs, district online high schools, tribal affiliated high schools, and competency-based high schools. I'd like to just share that we have an information session with the competency-based high schools across the state next week. And then I've been working very closely with our tribal liaison, Raphael Eubanks, to make sure that we are also supporting our Bureau of Indian Education tribal-affiliated schools, as well as other schools that have large Native American and Indigenous student population as well. We continue to make progress and have more streamlined access for both our K-12 and college partners through technology enhancements. For those of you who remember last year's report, we had two student information systems of the five across the state who had direct admissions capabilities within their technology platforms. Really excited to report that at the outset of this upcoming fall, we should have four of the five. And for that fifth, we have struck up some conversation with our colleagues at MDE about the EDFI compliance standards to see if that might be something that could be supported in terms of direct admissions integration as well. We continue to build broader consensus through community collaboration and amplifying the program across college access groups, foundations, and other interested parties. And we'll continue to strengthen messaging around the importance of financial aid, as well as the value of Minnesota opportunities to all of our students and families across the state. So again, really excited and privileged to be here to talk to you about this program. I'd like to ask again if there's any questions that we can answer while we're here today.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Are there any questions for members? Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Chair. Just one quick one in regards to what on the last slide that we had previous to this. Is there any ability for homeschool kids to access this, or is there any plans in the future to create some access for homeschoolers?
Mr. Selsick or Dr. Robinson?
Thank you for the question, Chair Fateh, Senator Rarick. We've actually had a few conversations with homeschool consortiums across the state. I think one of the challenges is that the academic review is conducted by sort of a third party. In most instances at the high school level, it's a school counselor or a school staff member. We have yet to sort of find a certifying process for whom that neutral party would be, but we're still exploring those options. One of the critical, I guess, side projects that could support that work is some of the learnings and the alternate model we're developing with the competency-based schools. In those instances, though, they still have a counselor at the local level that help with the tiering. Yeah, great question, and we have had those conversations. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Any other members with questions? Senator Umuverbein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two questions. It's really great to see that the program is growing. And I'm curious what feedback you get from schools who aren't participating, if there's any common challenges that they're experiencing. And then what are some of the best practices that you see from schools as well, where they're making sure that counselors are having these conversations with students, teachers? Would love to know anything I can bring back to my district, and I see that I have a lot of participating schools, which is great.
Dr. Robertson.
Yeah, thank you for the Chair Fateh and Senator for the question. I'll get started and then I'll defer to Aaron for some of that. I'm going to answer the second question first, which is some of the best practices. I will say, one of the things that we've really looked at as the program has been implemented and we're scaling up is to see, the schools that do have higher participation rates, what are they doing? How are they promoting the program? What does that look like for them? I think a couple of the things that I would highlight as best practices are, first, getting their letters out earlier rather than later. We would like to get to the point where every school that's participating is getting their students their direct admissions letter in September, early October, to really align with, October is College Knowledge Month, and there's a lot of programming around that. I also think that's a more meaningful time for students to get that information. Sometimes we've had some, in the pilot year, we had schools that didn't get their letters out to their students until March, and that's probably not as meaningful of an interaction. So I think trying to get that work done early in the senior year and getting that letter out early is really beneficial. I think ensuring that parents are aware of direct admissions, and so including information about the program in their parent newsletter, in their back to school events or in their college or college planning events that they have, so that the parents kind of have an awareness that the letter is coming and can be in dialogue with their students around that. I also think that we've had some schools that have really turned it into a celebration. And so, we've had a school that brought all of their students into an auditorium and everybody got their letter at the same time. And so everybody got to open their letter and see their friends opening their letter. And I think that was a really powerful experience for a lot of those students. I think other schools have looked at, kind of some of the wraparound things, and so trying to make it more of an event, I think can be a really nice way to highlight that as well. And now I'll turn it over to Aaron to see if he has anything to add, and then to also address the first part of that question.
Yes, thank you for the question, Chair Fateh and Senator Umuverbein. Before I turn to the challenges, the best practices are gleaned in a couple of different ways. I think that's important to share. One is that actually right now we're assessing from our current participants how the program worked for them. What did they do at the local level to successfully promote, market the program? Essentially, what is your internal book of business? In seeking that information, we also then add it to the program manual. And so each successive year's cohort gets stronger and implements at an earlier timeline. In terms of the challenges, I think the two biggest ones are still the technology. If it's not successfully built within the student information system platform, and or if they don't have sort of the technology staff at the local level, I tend to spend a bit more time with those schools in terms of successful implementation. I'm hoping that that dissipates now that we're gonna be in 4 of the 5 student information systems next year. And we do have a few other plans in the works for an alternate model where we reduce the technology capacity or needs of our counselors with OHI actually managing the survey sending, which should actually streamline the process too. The other one is staffing. Really at the high school level, the counselors are the heartbeat of this program. And so if a staffing member is ill unexpectedly or, you know, goes out of the office on needed leave or time, sometimes the program can fail. What we put into place this year was I actually created a program application that was sort of less an application and more who is your roster of folks at the local level so that if you are gone, we know who to reach out to next. And that has been really successful. Actually, if we were to go back in the data, you'd see that the attrition from this year's program was far less than the prior year. So I think that those are some efforts that are helping with some of that.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Thank you so much for the presentation.
All right, thank you.
Before we move on to the next presenters, we have a new member, Senator Doran Clark, who was tardy to the first day of class. But then I saw him walk in with Senator Putnam, and that makes sense. It made sense, yeah. So welcome, Senator Doran.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I was with the professor, so I think that gave me, but I wasn't with the chair. So thank you for having me on your committee. I look forward to it. Higher ed is a passion. I'm on the board of a local university, and so this is part of the fun.
Thank you so much, Senator Clark. Next up, we got a presentation from the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. With us today is Ms. Hegard and Dr. Waiterspan. Welcome. Please introduce yourselves for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Susan Hegard. I'm the president of the Midwestern Higher Education Compact. I'm just trying to get some clarification whether I need a laptop up here or not. We weren't aware of that, but we've got one.
Yeah, the pages are working on it, I believe.
Okay, should I just, and I think we have the slides for everybody. Did you get this handout? Great, so you've got that. We'll just work from.
Do you have a laptop to connect to?
Yeah, I apologize. What I will add, Mr. Chair and members, while we're getting ready here, is that we've got a packet for you, and in that packet, we've got a highlight sheet that kind of gives you the, at a high level, the ROI and the benefits to Minnesota. We've got our technology contract user list, so you can see this is the one part of our program where you can use our contracts, whether you're a local unit of government, a higher ed institution, public or private, or a K-12 school district. We also have a user list for our student health insurance programs, and which you don't use in Minnesota, but I don't think. But the Midwest Student State Reciprocity Agreement, MSARA, which is the distance education. In the packet's also a terrific report and response to this committee written by my colleague, Dr. Waiterspan, who you'll hear from after I present. And with that, I think I'll just get started on the slides. All right, so on your first slide, I just want to express my gratitude to you for inviting us to present here today. I've spent many days and many nights in this building over 30 years in my various jobs, so it's fun to be back in my current capacity as the leading the compact. This is the time of year when we visit all 12 state capitals in the Midwest. So we've visited Kansas and Nebraska so far, with many more to come. And it's just a terrific opportunity. I really enjoy these visits. I'm joined by a number of folks on my staff back here, and I'm very grateful. I couldn't do my job without them. So our purpose is to work in partnership with our 12 member states. It's really the Midwest Census region to strengthen post-secondary education through cost savings initiatives and collaborative solutions. So I like to say there are two sides of our business. One are our cost savings programs and contracts, and the other part of our business is our policy and our research. We were created in 1991 through the Council of State Governments Midwest Legislative Conference, and I know some of you are quite familiar with that organization. You probably are either involved with them or with NCSL. those two legislative organizations. I have 60 bosses, half of them are roughly legislators, and half of them are higher ed leaders from either campuses or from system offices. And there are about five from each state. The annual commitment from each state is $115,000. That's the appropriation. And I want to express my gratitude for that appropriation. It threads through Commissioner Olson's office. On the next page, you'll see some photographs of our Minnesota commissioners. There are three folks appointed by the governor and then two by the respective legislative bodies. So, of course, Senator Fateh, thank you very much for agreeing to be one of our commissioners. We have an open spot on the House side that we're working on. And from the U, we have Rachel Croson, who's the provost, Commissioner Olson from the Office of Higher Ed, and then Chancellor Olson from Minnesota State. So we've got nice representation. Then we have an alternate commissioner, Paul Cerkvenik, to kind of fill out the dance card with that perspective on private colleges. Following that slide, the MECS value to Minnesota. So like I said, we have two sides of our business, technology hardware and software and services, student health solutions, and insurance programs. On the hardware software side of things, the savings really arises because there's about a 10% savings that you get when you do the bulk purchasing on the contracts, but the real savings that adds up is that we stand in the shoes of the state and the contractor, because we're written into state statute, we're an instrumentality of state government, so we can do the RFP and we can do all that work on the contract, and then whoever wants to use the contract can tailor it as they see fit.
President Haggard, would you like us to pause so that the pages can connect the laptop?
That'd be great, thank you.
Thank you. There you go. Okay. Can they see it?
Yes, we do. You're here.
Can they see it? Okay. Are you good? All right. Thanks for your patience. All righty. You can hear me okay? Great. All right. So moving on. I guess I should back up for a second. And for those of you that aren't familiar with what a compact is, a compact has its roots in the Constitution. It allows a state to do business with one or more states without the federal government's involvement, unless you're bumping up against the work that they do, so transporting nuclear waste, things like that. There are compacts for hunting, fishing, dentistry, nurses, you name it. So we're a compact focused on higher education, and we were founded back in 1991. There are four regional compacts total. There are three, one in the West, one in the South, and one in the Northeast, and we are in the Midwest. Anyway, we like to talk about our ROI. So for FY24, the cost savings for Minnesota, $9.26 million in total annual savings for the colleges, universities, school districts, state, and local government. And as I mentioned, on your we've got the user list available for you. That comes out to be about an 81-fold return on your membership commitment of $115,000. You, as a state, have saved $2.33 million on technology. The biggest contracts used in Minnesota are Dell, Oracle, Xerox, Campus Guard, and others. And then big savings on distance education through the Midwestern State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement, or MSARA. Love our acronyms in higher education. But really, before, the easiest way to describe that is if you wanted to offer an online program as an institution, public or private, before, you had to register in every state where you wanted to offer that program. Now you just have to do it once. You do it through our compact, and it saves lots of time and money. And it's been a terrific offering over the last 10 years. other Minnesota benefits. We do have a Midwest Student Exchange Program. Families that participated in that saved about $2.8 million. That rests against those state-to-state reciprocity programs like Wisconsin and Minnesota or North Dakota and Minnesota. The challenge there, we're taking a hard look at that program, and Carrie on our team is leading that work because, as you know, many institutions and states have eliminated out-of-state tuition. And so it's really kind of removed, in some cases, that need for having a reciprocity agreement. We also, back in the day, helped create Minitex, the library network, got a grant to do that. And we provide research to Minnesota leaders on a number of topics. So this actually presentation came about because Sam had asked us for some information on college access programs, and we're gonna get to that shortly. We had 9 Minnesota leaders attend our FAFSA summit. That was another issue that bubbled up during our visits. And so we had a summit this summer trying to help folks navigate the challenges with the kind of very troubling rolling out of the FAFSA last year. Well-intentioned, but difficult. And then 8 tech leaders attended our professional development and networking. So let's get to the data. And I will confess, I used to advise for the Lumina Foundation. I worked with Minnesota on the attainment goal way back when. And so I like this slide a lot. It shows you the educatedness of the state, meaning anybody that has a credential beyond high school. So the Lumina Foundation, they're in Indianapolis. They have led the work around the country on this. So for Minnesota, about 61% of Minnesotans have a post-secondary certificate or higher compared to 54% nationally. So you can just see how that tracks out. What's great is that we're moving in the right direction. There's county data in the Lumina Foundation, so you'll see that there are probably counties in Minnesota that are way above that 60%, and there are a number of counties that are way, way below that. This is my favorite slide. This really shows you this horizontal chart that's quite colorful, how those credentials break out. Because I guess if you think about it, it's really important to have a broadly educated workforce. So you want techs and you want engineers and chemists, right? And everything in between, depending on your particular industry. So the royal blue is 6% of folks don't have a high school diploma, 21% orange have a high school diploma, 13% of some college and no credential. One of the big challenges there is, as you know, one of the most difficult things for a student is when they have not completed something that they've started and they go into debt. So they don't have anything to show for it and they have debt. And I know that you've had hearings on that. So that would be sort of what that would represent there. The violet and the green would be certifications, then 2-year degrees, 4-year degrees, and beyond. Then what we try to do with these slides, we're not trying to kind of boil the ocean, but show you from several different important perspectives what the state looks like. And we do the same presentation pretty much in every capital, but it's tailored. So in terms of enrollment, this is data out of the Western Compact, WICHE. High school graduates are projected to decrease in Minnesota over the coming decade, with decreases for white graduates and increases in underrepresented graduates, non-white graduates. So that's very similar across the Midwest. The overall population's flattening out or dropping. The white population's dropping faster than the overall population. And the part that's growing are folks that are non-white. Then with respect to enrollment, undergraduate enrollment at Minnesota public 2-year and public 4-year institutions, this is an average, has declined since 2010 and 11. So that also is a fairly common trend across the Midwest. Now, there's a 2-year lag in this data. And so I think that one of the things that we could go back and do is we could actually tell you more specifically, and we've got a really great data dashboard. Some of those numbers have ticked up because I'm sure you'll hear from MnState and others that some of their enrollment numbers are up. So this is an average. There's a lag in the data, and we've seen some promising uptick in some of the numbers. But overall, there's a trend down.
Senator Duckworth.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And we did have OHE in here earlier that told us they were beginning to see some uptick in enrollment. Do you know, are other states in the compact experiencing that, or does that seem to be just in Minnesota? Just curious if you have any awareness of that.
President Hegarth.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is a trend that we're seeing in some places. So it's good news. There's always that data lag, so it's hard to actually show that, especially when there's an average. But yeah, we're seeing some trends in a positive direction. I think the question is that going to stick? Is it kind of a blip, an aberration, or is it something that's sustained? Okay, this slide shows that more students migrate out of Minnesota than migrate in. We just show border states here because that's probably where most folks end up going. So the net in, and this is just a year out from graduation, so keep that in mind. The net in-migration of high school graduates who enrolled in a post-secondary institution within 12 months of graduating from high school or receiving a GED or a GED diploma or graduating from high school. So Minnesota, you know, we're an exporter. But as you know, a lot of those folks might go to NDSU or they might go to Madison and they tend to come home. There's a great project. I know the Office of Higher Ed is engaged with the Census Bureau. It's called PSEO, not post-secondary enrollment options, but it's PSEO. And they're able to look at some of this data 5 and 10 years out. And like in Iowa, where I learned about it, they're able to see that, yeah, their students go away for, you know, 5 years, but then they come home ultimately. So there's pretty, there are a lot of opportunities to disaggregate and dig into this data. But again, these are just snapshots. This is a similar way of looking at the data, but across the 12 states. So you'll see that in Minnesota, right in the middle, 64% of our students stay in state, 26% head out to a Midwestern state, 11% head to a coast or where there's more sun and warmth. But again, this is a year out, so most of those folks come back. We have done some research, which I'm not able to kind of pull out of my pocket today, but on the impact of the North Star program. I know our folks in North Dakota that we visit with are quite concerned about it. And so we'll probably we'll see some of those numbers shift a bit with respect to that program.
Senator Duckworth.
Thank you. I appreciate it. This is a very interesting slide. And as I look at it, turn it sideways, and see that really Minnesota and Illinois are kind of the two that are at the bottom. When you're gathering this data, do you ask students or families as to why that might be the case? I know we can guess in terms of maybe better climate or weather in some areas or states. Really what I'm asking is, do people tell you it's because of the cost of tuition, or why do we see so many of our students choose to go to other states?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is some data on this, at least from what I can tell you right here, and I will invite my colleague to chime in if he feels so moved. But Illinois and Minnesota are pretty different. So Illinois has bled students. Great state, but they're losing students for different reasons than Minnesota would be. And there's heavy recruitment from other states and institutions in Illinois. You know, there's Chicago, and then there's the rest of the state. You know that well if you're from there. Minnesota, though, I think what happens is we're a large population center. We have a much larger population than our border states. And so our students tend to, you know, want to have a different experience, you know, and try something else. Like in South Dakota, and I believe in North Dakota, they've eliminated out-of-state tuition, so it's the same price, right? So those are some of the reasons that I can think of right now.
I think spot on. She has highlighted that. I think for the most part, the question that you're asking, why do people choose where they go, is something in research that we've been trying to grapple with for years, right? There's numerous reasons, can't digest them all. But I can at least tell you, like looking at the graph, you know, you highlighted Illinois as an example. They're actually going to Iowa. Iowa is actually a major importer for Illinois. Iowa gets a lot from Chicago, basically. There's not a clearly defined reason, and the data is not necessarily going to reflect all of that personal decision making.
Chair Fata.
Senator Clark.
Thank you, Chair Fata, presenters. Have you looked at the percentage of college-bound high school seniors in each of these? Because this may be a leading question. I think it's that we have a higher percentage of college-bound seniors in Minnesota than a lot of the other states, and so just a bigger, maybe a bigger supply is as part of the answer.
President Hager.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, we've collected some of that data at the office. Like I said, we have a larger population. We have a higher attainment than our neighboring states. And, you know, our major metropolitan area is snugged pretty close to the Wisconsin border, you know, but our students can have lots of choices, you know, both great choices in the state and elsewhere too. But if you'd like more information on that, my folks are taking notes, so we could get back to you on that.
Yes, please.
Great. Then we have a slide on net price. And so again, there's a lag in this data as well. So this wouldn't yet reflect the North Star, the Promise program. But for two-year college prices, the average net price, and that's where you pull out, you know, the financial aid, et cetera, for low-income students. So we decided to take two groups. Those are their Pell eligible at about 30,000, and then students from families of 110 or more. So your average net price for low-income students at Minnesota public two-year institutions is higher than the Midwest and national averages, but lower than South Dakota. So you can look across there. And in some cases, it's a lot. And in most cases, it's not as much as you'd think. For the students from higher income families, it's a little bit closer. But I think the question is, with the additional investment in financial aid as well as the North Star program, would that look different? For four-year colleges, the average net price for low-income students at Minnesota public four-year institutions is lower than the Midwest and national averages, and lower than Iowa, North Dakota, and South Dakota. So you can see the same thing. The blue is 30,000 Pell eligible, and then the orange would represent families from 110 or more. With that, I am going to hand this off to my colleague, Dr. Wiederspan, and we really feel that the data shows that investing in student success programs, you may disagree, you know, among you about which ones make the most sense, but you know, the good ones do make a difference. My daughter's in the back and she's with College Possible as an advisor right now. With that, my colleague, Dr. Wiederspan.
Thank you everyone for letting me have the opportunity to come speak to you today. As Susan was mentioning, over the past year, MEC has been really doing a wonderful job in examining FAFSA completion and what are sort of the activities that states need to do to help encourage students complete that form. And as sort of a spin-off of that, one of your staff members asked, okay, what are other states doing with regards to helping promote college access within their states? So the brief that we have prepared, and there is an updated version for you that we've included some additional information about Minnesota in some of those tables. But the intent was just basically to show you what are some of the things that states in the Midwest are doing, okay? But before I do all that, and especially we had a presentation from the Office of Higher Education, I think maybe it's also really important to at least give you some research insight into why some of these states are doing these activities, and why are they doing some of their activities in helping promote college going within their schools. So really what I was doing is I'd taken a look at what is the research found with regards to effective school counseling for college going. Please note that I'm talking about college and post-secondary education. I'm using those terms interchangeably. So really what we're looking at is six different kinds of interventions that can happen at a high school, okay? Now, we're not necessarily looking at interventions on the academic side, right? So, you know, I'm just trying to think of dual enrollment as an example. Really, we're more focusing on what are the counseling and advising that can take place within a high school. And really what we did is we're taking a look at six of them. The first one is information-only interventions. Okay, information-only interventions are considered like light-touch interactions with students. Believe it or not, you probably get bombarded every day with light-touch interactions and you don't even know, like a commercial. We could say a commercial is an example of a light-touch interaction, right? In general, what the research has found is that sending general college-related information or just hanging posters about a financial aid program is not very effective in helping promote college enrollment and FAFSA completion. But what is very beneficial is providing personalized information about financial aid options and eligibility has been found to increase enrollment in high-achieving, low-income students. In particular, I'm looking at a study that was done at the University of Michigan. They sent a personalized letter to every single student that had a qualifying ACT and SAT that essentially guaranteed them admission to Michigan. And they sent them a guaranteed letter saying, hey, we noticed your ACT, SAT score. Based on this, if you came to Michigan, you would go debt-free. And that was very effective because it was very personalized information specific to that individual. Another thing that's being very common lately is the use of text messaging, right? Text messaging is also another form of light touch intervention, and it provides students and families with reminders and information about the college going process and the FAFSA application. On a small scale, text messaging has been found effective in targeting specific populations and helping them with the FAFSA completion and helping them with the college going process. Once again, this is a very personalized, specific text message that goes to an individual. Whereas if it's very broad and it's done at national scale, the studies have been done, they haven't been really found to be very effective. Here's a good example. If I sent you a text message to say, oh, I noticed you're going to college, have you filled out your FAFSA, talk to your high school counselor, is that gonna be more effective than if I said to you, hey, I noticed you are college bound, need help with the FAFSA, talk to Ms. Wilkins in your guidance counseling office, right? That's probably going to elicit a more proactive response than just a general information, okay? Another one is high school counseling. Again, school counseling has traditionally and has always shown to be positive in helping with FAFSA completion, as well as college enrollment rates and increasing the college application rates. The issue that many times that we're facing with that school counseling is that their capacity limits their ability. School counselors are not just limited to helping prepare kids to go to college. They're also dealing with some of the socio issues that are going on or the psychological issues that are going on in their school. So their focus is not always going to be helping students college bound. So that sort of capacity oftentimes limits their ability. Another thing that has been going on lately is many school districts have introduced like sort of nonprofits and partnerships between high schools and colleges to provide students with college advisors, coaches, and mentors. This one-on-one assistance with college information has been proven to be effective. Previous studies have found that this one-on-one interaction helps to improve college intentions as well as enrollment rates, especially amongst those that are identified as being traditionally disadvantaged. Another thing that is also common, in absence of being able to do something in person, virtual advising is very helpful, right? We can't go everywhere. I think the office had even mentioned that that's a very important outreach, is because they can't be everywhere at once. You know, in absence of providing in-person advising, virtual or remote advising has been shown to be pretty effective in helping with college enrollment outcomes. This can include face-to-face sessions, emails, phone calls, and text message exchanges. Notice that when I'm saying exchanges is a lot different than just sending a text message, but rather having an interaction with somebody through a text messaging platform that you're talking with them through. However, a lot of the virtual advising, the research has been somewhat limited and only helping those that are highly motivated or high achieving or those that are already going onto the path. Because many times the virtual is already set up to help assist those that are already in the process of making, they've already decided that they're going to college. That virtual is just helping them guide through the process. In comparing remote advising to in-person, you know, outcomes are going to be larger than with in-person, right? But even with no advising, virtual is still going to be more effective. Lastly is the notion of school-based college-going programs that are embedded within the school operation. So looking at taking school-based approaches to integrate college-going process within the school curriculum and providing a staff resources. There has been found to be an increase in college enrollment and FAFSA rates. I think, though, the design of how that is embedded into the curriculum really matters. So, for example, if you're doing FAFSA outreach, embedding the process of how to complete the FAFSA within the classroom is going to be more effective than just providing general information about the FAFSA. The big thing, though, also is that the research on sort of embedding this college-going process within the curriculum has been pretty limited. It has been shown to be pretty effective, but it's only been found effective in a small number of high schools because that's the few number of high schools that have actually done such an activity. So now that we've kind of looked at what are sort of the activities and interventions that have taken place within high schools, particularly the activities that states can do, the question that was posed by your staff members were, like, how do states structure their college and access and success work, including what are the number of full-time equivalent staff, where do they place their FTEs throughout the state, and what is the focus of their work? And then lastly, how much money do these states put in for college and access and success initiatives? How much are they using from their state appropriation? To do this, I was really excited because no one does this. No one's really done a study or no one's really kind of examined on a state-by-state basis of how states are using their money for college access and success initiatives. So what MEC did was is we developed a survey and we administered it to the 12 Midwestern states. We were very purposeful in targeting this survey to the states that are members of the National Association of State Student Grant and Aid Programs. The Office of Higher Education is a member of NASGAP, is what we call it. But traditionally, that is the office that not only administers all the financial aid programs, but it also is traditionally responsible for the college outreach programs. 11 out of the 12 states responded, so we had about 92% response rate. All the states that responded to this reported overseeing at least one college access and success initiative program. But I do want to note, though, at the time of doing the survey, three of the states had implemented a universal FAFSA policy. So having the expectation that the student needs to complete the FAFSA before they leave high school. So Illinois, Indiana, and Nebraska all have a universal FAFSA policy. Michigan, at the time of doing the survey, was currently in the process of planning for an implementation of a universal FAFSA. So that is just something to consider as we're doing this, is that those activities obviously spawned the need for those agencies to do college outreach. Broadly speaking, what are the types of services that your state provides? Minnesota responses were in bold. A vast majority of the states are focusing on the finance aspect of going to college. So this is like FAFSA completion, helping oversee the financial aid program, providing sort of information and support. Less states are providing support in college and career counseling. Minnesota is one of the three of the 12 states that is doing that. Virtually no state agency is providing support to students through test preparation. There could be some test preparation done through collaboration that the office is doing, like they mentioned, Gear Up. I know Gear Up is probably doing some sort of test preparation, but the overall structure of their agency is not addressing test preparation. And then also there's just outreach coordination and recruitment and helping students go through the college application process. So those are really the types of work that they're doing. What are the activities? And so here's just a list of activities that I found through the survey, and I grouped them together. Again, the activities that Minnesota are taking are in bold. Again, you'll notice a similar trend that a lot of the focus is on the finance aspect, helping students through that finance aspect. But very few states are engaging activities that would support students through the summer. Minnesota and Iowa were the only two states that indicated that they are providing that services, but that's a very key service because we want to reduce summer melt, so it's good to see that that activity is taking place in this state. But again, a lot of the stuff that is being developed is for college information, helping students get through the FAFSA. Another key aspect that I also would like to draw your attention to, especially what they're doing here in Minnesota, is providing the training necessary to help high school counselors assist students through the college or assist students go through the college and FAFSA applications. That's a very key aspect that is taking place here in Minnesota also. Lastly, another common aspect is the maintaining of FAFSA completion dashboards. Now that we have a supposed more simplified form, we do have a more simplified form. It's just the rollout hasn't been as successful, but it's good to know that we can keep track of it in some public fashion. So what are some of the funding activities that are taking place across the nation or across these states? Seven of the 11 states agencies did report that they are receiving some sort of state appropriation to help their college access and success initiatives. Now there's significant variation that you'll notice on here from a low of roughly $640,000 to $27 million. But what really matters, though, is how that money is allocated and doled out. So Kansas, for example, does $27 million. Their agency provides $27 million, but that's actually provided directly to the public institutions themselves. So while the agency may not do direct college access and success work, they pass the money on to the public institutions themselves to take on those activities. Michigan is another example where they have about $21 million, but $20 million of it is a set aside for FAFSA grants and stipends that they provide to their high schools. As you remember, as I mentioned earlier, they're rolling out the new FAFSA, universal FAFSA. Some of that is to help those high schools meet their FAFSA goals. Minnesota uses roughly about 2.6. How they use their 2.6 is very diversified. Some of it is for gear up. Some of it is for direct admissions. They've also noted that they use some of that for grants. They provided a grant to one nonprofit to assist in helping students go through the college application process. In terms of funding,
Senator
in addition
Rarick,
to, yeah, go
sorry
ahead.
To interrupt you, Senator Rarick.
A quick question on that.
Yeah.
Seeing that the number seven was fairly common, or five or six, is it fair to say that the seven states that have agencies that appropriate some type of money are the ones who are involved in programs and the other four are typically doing nothing?
I wouldn't say that they're doing nothing. I think what they're doing, those other states are relying on collaboration from other nonprofits to oversee the college going process within their state. A good example is Nebraska. Nebraska does have a universal FAFSA policy. Their state oversees that FAFSA completion for high schools, but they leverage on a local nonprofit to help them oversee on all the college going process within the state. It is a very wealthy nonprofit, and they oversee all the college going activities for that state, and so the state relies on that nonprofit. So that's the kind of thing that you see in those other states, is it's not that they don't want to do it, is they're really leveraging more on the nonprofits to take the lead on that. In addition to just state appropriations, eight of the 11 agencies also indicated that they really do rely on external sources. So here in Minnesota, you mentioned Gear Up was discussed. So that is another source of good funding to help promote some of the college-going activities within the state. So federal funding, this could help support TRIO, Gear Up, AmeriCorps, and even just U.S. Department of Education grants. Another aspect of Minnesota, too, is the nonprofit or private foundation grant funding. I think the previous speakers had mentioned that they received a grant from Lumina. That provides assistance in some of their activities. The last one is the revenue from agency programs. Many states just leverage or utilize some of the fees, service charges, loan collections. Iowa is an example where Iowa used to be a student loan guarantee agency. It has an outstanding student loan portfolio, and it can rely on that student loan portfolio to help subsidize their college-going activities. So in terms of staff support, six of the 11 agencies have dedicated employees through a number of FTEs, and Where they're located varies greatly, and there's significant variation on the number of FTEs that there are throughout the state. So Illinois, as an example, does have a universal FAFSA, and they have 90 FTEs, right? And 84 of them are distributed across the state that are aligned with the community college district. So a large portion of that FTEs is built in because of their universal FAFSA program. Indiana also has 11, and they work in a central office, and they're distributed throughout the state. Iowa has 20, Michigan has 10, and Missouri has 5. All the states reported that their FTEs are to assist students through the college-going process. So this could be helping with college applications. This could be helping determine which college you go to. This could also involve helping out completing the FAFSAs. Here in Minnesota, Minnesota indicated that they have about 20 FTEs dedicated to college access and success initiatives. They really rely strongly on collaboration with external organizations, and those 20 FTEs are not necessarily 100% funded by the state. That is a mix also of federal and state funding. Like I mentioned earlier, that they're receiving Gear Up funding that helps support some of those, some of that work too. So, in general, overview, the Midwest states, Minnesota especially, does prioritize FAFSA completion and college-going initiatives, but there are significant variations in how their allocations are done for resources, staffing, and activities. In terms of research, again, the research suggests that personalized, targeted support strategies are key to improving college access outcomes. In-person advising and counseling is important for college access and outcomes, but in absence of in-person, virtual advising shows promise. This concludes my slide. I do have references on there. If you're like me, you do want to possibly read the study. The list is provided at the back of the slides. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Senator Duckworth.
Thank you. It's really just a brief comment. Also, it's very higher education committee of you to have a list of references at the end of your presentation. So thank you. Just briefly, getting back to this slide, which kind of showed, you know, some of the different schools and things. In the future, what might be helpful are some information in future presentations that you do in other state capitals. I would be curious to know of these states that we're kind of drawing comparisons from, because it's very helpful to do those comparisons. I would like to know how many colleges or universities are in each of these respective states. Then also maybe on an annual basis, how many graduates each of those states typically tend to see, whether that's by 2 year, 4 year, whatever, just to kind of help give some context to that comparison as well. Because again, I appreciate the information and thank you for it. In the future, those would be some other pieces of information I think would be very insightful as well. So thank you.
President Higgard.
Mr. Chair and Senator, thanks. That's a great suggestion. We'll follow up with you more directly, talk to Sam as well, but we have a data dashboard. We've got that data for you, and we can share that with respect to Minnesota. I think we'll do is we'll send it to you, and then you can distribute it to your members, correct?
Thank you so much. Thank you. Great. Any other questions for members? Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry about the mix-up on the laptop.
No, thank you.
Right. And we'll do it next time.
Next up, we have our budget walkthrough from nonpartisan staff. Welcome. Please introduce yourselves for the record and begin.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Megan Birch, and I'm the nonpartisan fiscal analyst with Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis supporting the Higher Education Committee. Today, I'm going to walk you through a high-level summary of both. Sorry about that. Of both the November 2024 forecast and the governor's 2025 change item recommendations. So in your packet, you should have two tracking spreadsheets, I think aptly titled November 2024 forecast and 2025 governor's recommended change items in the upper left-hand corners. So I'm going to start with the forecast spreadsheet, which provides a high-level summary of what we consider the base for this year's budgetary decision-making, before we move on to the change item spreadsheet to discuss proposed incremental changes to that base. So on that forecast spreadsheet, I'm going to focus on columns D through I, which represent the budget and planning biennia, where your primary focus will be this session. The current biennium is also shown in columns A through C, so you can see what was appropriated in the past, but it's more of a reference than anything else for right now. As a reminder, all numbers are in thousands of dollars. I don't think we ever did a committee jurisdiction walkthrough, so I'll just remind you that the higher education budget jurisdiction includes the Office of Higher Education, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the University of Minnesota, Mayo Medical School, and the Higher Education Facilities Authority. And an immediate disclaimer that the numbers in this spreadsheet do not reflect every single dollar that each of these agencies has the authority to spend. And that wasn't my intention here. What they do reflect are the direct appropriations to agencies within the higher education jurisdiction that would come before you in an omnibus bill. So I think it might be helpful to think about it as the foundation of the budget that you are all tasked with building this session. So that's what I'll be reviewing for each agency, starting with the Office of Higher Education on line 6. So direct appropriations to the Office of Higher Education are entirely from the general fund. OHE has a base of $725,141,000 for the 26-27 biennium and $725,194,000 for the 28-29 biennium. And about 75% or so of those totals is for the state grant program and the North Star Promise alone. I also want to note that funding for several of the student grant programs in OHE, including North Star Promise, are transferred directly from the general fund into accounts in the special revenue fund. So the grants themselves are awarded out of a special revenue fund, but because the original appropriation is in the general fund, that's where we track it. So moving on to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities on line 9, their direct appropriations are also entirely from the general fund. Minn State has a base of $1,751,389,000 for the 26-27 biennium and $1,751,400,000 in the 28-29 biennium. And about 95% of that is included as operations and maintenance. Next, we have the University of Minnesota on line 12. The U has a total all funds base of $1,494,278,000 in each of the 26-27 and 28-29 biennia. And about 90% of that is included as operations and maintenance. Of the total amount, $1,489,964,000 in each biennium is in the general fund, and $4,314,000 is in the healthcare access fund for primary care education initiatives. There were also one-time appropriations in the 24-25 biennium from the Workforce Development Fund for the Center for Nursing Equity and Excellence and from the Family and Medical Benefit Insurance Fund for paid leave. Last but not least, the Mayo Medical School budget on line 18 is made up entirely of direct appropriations from the general fund. Mayo has a general fund base of $3,598,000 in each of the 26-27 and 28-29 biennia. You may have noticed that the Higher Education Facilities Authority isn't on the spreadsheet, despite me saying that it's in the jurisdiction of this committee, and you won't find it on most other tracking spreadsheets either, and that's just because the agency doesn't have any direct appropriations, so there's just nothing for us to track here. But coming back up to the top of the spreadsheet to kind of bring everything together, the higher education budget jurisdiction has a total all funds base of $3,974,406,000 for the 26-27 biennium and $3,974,470,000 for the 28-29 biennium. Of that, $3,970,092,000 is in the general fund in 26-27, and $3,970,156,000 is in the general fund in 28-29. This was obviously a very high-level summary, I thought reviewing 19 lines would be preferable to the something like 175 in my more like detailed tracking spreadsheet. But if and when you're looking for more information about a specific program or a line item appropriation, you can either find it in the higher education spreadsheets that are posted to the SCRPA website, or always feel free to reach out to me with whatever questions you have. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to either answer questions members have about the November forecast now before I move on to change items, or I can take questions on everything at the end, whatever you'd prefer.
Are there any questions first, Senator Utke?
Thank you. The offer was made to send out the complete spreadsheet, so we'd have a digital file of that. I'd like that if we could get it.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? You may proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. So moving over to the 2025 Governor's Recommended Change Item spreadsheet, I'm going to walk you through a high-level summary of the change item recommendations that MMB has identified as having a fiscal impact. So there are no recommended change items for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, Mayo Medical School, or Higher Education Facilities Authority. And there are two recommended change items for the University of Minnesota, but they're both in the Clean Water Fund, which is in the Environment Committee's budget jurisdiction. So we won't talk about them here today. So really the whole discussion of 2025 governor's recommended change items today will focus on the three items that have fiscal impact recommended for the Office of Higher Education. So the first of two items recommended for OHE in the general fund is an operating adjustment on line 8. The governor's recommendation is a $490,000 increase in the 26-27 biennium and a $656,000 increase in the 28-29 biennium. That represents a less than 1% increase to the total Office of Higher Education budget, but because the vast majority of the OHE budget is direct grants and financial aid, I think it might be more helpful to consider it in relation to the agency administration line item, where the recommended increases are a little bit more than 4% in 26-27 and just shy of 5.5% in 28-29. On line 9, the second of two items recommended in the general fund is an increase to the state grant program of $15 million in each of the 26-27 and 28-29 biennia. And that adds to an existing base of $450,132,000 per biennium. This recommendation from the governor also comes with several changes to state grant program eligibility and award parameters, which I won't discuss now, but just want to raise for your awareness would be expected to decrease the Office of Higher Education's projected state grant program expenditures in future years. And then the third and final item recommended for the Office of Higher Education is a change to post-secondary institution licensing and registration fees to increase both special revenue fund expenses on line 12 and revenues on line 23 by $682,000 in each of 26-27 and 28-29. My understanding is that this is essentially an operating adjustment for OHE's licensing and registration division, which has had a structural deficit since fiscal year 17. But this is a statutory appropriation in the special revenue fund, so the amounts are the projected results of the recommended statutory changes and not a direct appropriation to the Office of Higher Education. So there are more change items for the Office of Higher Education in the governor's recommended budget, but they're all statutory changes that MMB did not identify as having a fiscal impact. So I'll leave those for a more policy-oriented discussion in the future. And I'm sure the department will also want to speak on all of those as well. So just coming back up to the top of the spreadsheet to summarize, the change items the governor recommends in the higher education budget jurisdiction have a net general fund impact of $15,490,000 in the 26-27 biennium and $15,656,000 in the 28-29 biennium. And no net special revenue fund impact in either biennium because the projected expense and revenue increases cancel each other out. With that, Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Awesome. Thanks, Megan. Are there any questions from members? Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really any questions, just putting some stuff out there for future meetings, if that's okay. So thank you very much for going through that information with us. In the future, when we talk about this some more, if OHI can come back and let us know, you know, looking at the $15 million increase over the $450 million base, just letting us know what the current state of that state grant program is and how this will likely impact it, or what that's actually going to mean in reality for them, the funds they have, and what they're able to allocate or disperse to students and families would be helpful. And then also, whether it's from them or some schools or whoever can talk about what this institution licensing and registration fee adjustment actually is, at what part of the process will kids be impacted by that, who's going to pay it, how much are we talking, what sort of an increase is it, would also be helpful to know. Obviously, things cost money. Our main goal here is to keep it as affordable as possible, so I just would be curious to see how that actually plays out in reality for folks as they're trying to budget and afford college and whatnot. And then there was something that you mentioned after you talked about the base funding and the $15 million proposed increase to the state grant fund. You said something about that there's an expectation that OHI would make some adjustments or something down the road. Do you know what I'm talking about, what you said after that? I was just curious if you'd expand upon that.
Megan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Duckworth, no, so part of the governor's recommendation is parameter changes to the state grant program as well that would be expected to kind of reduce future expenditures in comparison to what OHI is currently projecting. And so not that they would be making the changes, more that they would want to speak on them, likely.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Senator Duckworth.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And I think they may have given us a little bit of a teaser of that in their previous presentation. So that's something that I would like us the opportunity to dive in a little bit more with them as well when the time comes. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you both, Megan, and thank you, Senator Duckworth. In the future, we're going to have a full bill hearing on the governor's recommendations once we get those jackets, and we'll be able to also hear from the agency as well. So thank you so much, Senator. Any other questions? Seeing none, we are adjourned.